As you're examining this idea of taking as self the things that are not self, thinking that maybe it might be useful to hear a little bit about karma, because what is this that passes from lifetime to lifetime? You know, again, it's those two levels in a way. One way to think of it is that, you know, when you really look at the ultimate level of there not being an abiding self that goes on forever, is that whoever, whatever living being was contributing to this karmic stream that now you're experiencing, you know, how did they do? If one of the people who's part of our community in California, she has a very good life. You know, she's got all the things she would ever want and more, and, you know, just a very, very fortunate life. And she says, I think about those living beings that came before me, and they must have done a lot of good things, and I just don't want to drop the ball. This is a story that my cousin's husband told me about his life that I found pretty remarkable. And I had a chance, I heard this story a few years ago when I visited back home. Everybody back home is south of Chicago, northwestern Indiana, in that area. And recently one of my cousins passed away, and I went back for the funeral, and I got a chance to talk to Harry some more about this thing that happened to him. And he graduated from high school in 1968, and he said at that time you had three choices. It was either go to college, go to Canada, or go to Vietnam. And he said that he wasn't college material, and he had never been north of Dalton, which is a small town south of Chicago, and he didn't know how to get to Canada, so it was going to be Vietnam. He knew they were going to draft him, so he decided to enlist. They were offering a two-year tour of duty, and so he went into basic training. And Harry's a really devout Christian, and in basic training, he said he had this vision of himself sitting in a tree and shooting an enemy soldier in the head. And he said he could see like the hole the size of a baseball in this person's head. And he thought, I can't do that. I can't do that to anybody. I don't care who they are. And he said from then on he was praying that he would not kill anyone. And he was sent over, he said, you know, he was in the infantry, and he said this happened, he got there right after the Battle of Hamburger Hill, where the 101st Airborne Division really lost a lot of men. And so they wanted the first 50 guys off the plane, and Harry was among them. But he had no certificate, he had no training in airborne training. So he was, what do they call it, airborne ranger. So he didn't know anything about parachutes, but he was one of the guys that they would take up in a helicopter. He described it, the helicopters, they didn't have any doors. There'd be six men on board, two on each side with their feet hanging out, the doors holding on to the side, the bars on the side, and two in the middle, sitting back to back. And they would, I don't know, I've seen these photos where the helicopter doesn't even hardly land, just the guys jump out and they fight. And Harry, every time, well, they would drop his group on a mountain and they would send out other missions on other mountains. And wherever Harry went, there'd be no enemy. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And he said, you know, he'd be dropped on Mountain A and the others dropped on B and C and there'd be all kinds of fighting. Nothing on A, and then he gets dropped on C, and there's no fighting on C, and it's fighting everywhere else, and this happened over and over and over again. After 6 months of that, he'd fall asleep on the helicopter, dry on the ride. He's like, it was always hard to get enough sleep. He'd fall asleep, and another guy would say, how can you be asleep? Military intelligence says there's 1,500 enemy troops confirmed on this mountain. He said, there's nobody there. There's nobody there. And there would be nobody there. He was walking up the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which is like the thoroughfare for the Viet Cong. No one there. There's these mounds by the side of the road where an enemy would hide. They're going towards one, and they say, okay, somebody's got to investigate. We'll send Harry. There's nobody in there. He said that, you know, he had a reputation. He'd hear guys go, that was it, that's the guy. He said a new guy would come. Someone would say to him, you want to survive Vietnam? That's Harry. You stay by Harry. He goes down the hill to eat his sea ration. You go down the hill and you eat your sea ration. I got to say, Harry even told me, Harry goes out to take a dump. You go out and take... Harry's like, that's it. I don't go for that. Two guys squatting in the jungle. No. But he said as long as they stuck with him, they were fine. And they get transferred to another unit. They're in combat. After 11 months, well, the whole time, he never shot his gun. He said his captain would come along when he's in the camp, and he'd pick up Harry's gun, and he'd shoot it in the air. And Harry's like, what are you doing? I'm getting the rust out of your barrel. Look at that. You never shoot this thing. After 11 months, a new commander came to the camp, taking over. And he said, I'm going to show you all what a nice guy I am. The person who's been here the longest, I'm going to let them go back to base camp. They won't have to come out to the jungle again. And they said, well, that's Harry, but you can't take him because he's our good luck charm. Ugh, what are you talking about? That's crazy. Every man in the camp signed a petition, 200 guys, you can't take Harry. And the commander's like, this is ridiculous. He ripped it up, get on that helicopter. So Harry went back to base camp. And about 3 weeks later, that same commander was walking through base camp and he saw Harry and he stopped and he said, I am this close to believing your story because ever since you left, we've had constant combat. So Harry's explanation for this is prayer. He said he was praying that he would not kill anyone. He also said he was praying he didn't have to fire a shot. And he said his mom was praying for him, and his church was praying for him, his pastor was praying for him, his friends were praying for him, and he said, of course, they were praying that I don't get killed. But when I first heard his story, I was like really intrigued by the fact that that's what he cared about. He didn't want to kill anybody. You know, certainly that's different from most of us would probably be be more worried about our own safety. But also, I think there's more than prayer involved in this. Because I knew a lot of guys who went and didn't have that experience. A cousin of mine had a terrible experience. Agent Orange dropped all over him, guys dying on either side of him. He was wounded. He played dead, so he didn't die in that battle, but, you know. And from the perspective of the Dhamma and the way the Buddha talked about karma, I think, my guess is that there were lifetimes of not killing for Harry. And he said he doesn't like to go hunting. His son-in-law would love it if he would like be a hunt, you know, go hunting with him. And he's like, I don't want to kill anything. You know, and it's just striking how that could happen. 27 combat missions, he never saw combat. They mailed him the Bronze Star, because if you're in 25 or more missions, you get the Bronze Star. It's the second highest medal. And he didn't do anything to deserve it. He said, I'm a little ashamed of that. It's just extraordinary. How does it happen? What we do matters. The Buddha said, what we do matters. This karma that we create, taking care of the precepts. It's always like, you take care of the precepts, they'll take care of you. Even if we never remember our past lives or anything, you know, whatever we do now, it makes a difference. It makes a difference for the future. You see people come in with really strong ideas or likes and dislikes or propensity for something or a talent for something, and you get that sense that got practiced before. So when we think about, you know, like, what would we like to have happen in our next life, or what would we like to pass on, or what would we like to develop, like, even you feel like, well, maybe I'm getting, you know, too old to do something useful or something important, but boy, developing the mind and developing our character is extremely important. And we can do that for as long as we're breathing. So it's not an abiding self, but the Buddha put huge emphasis on virtue and generosity, development of wisdom. So I thought I would share another sutta with you. It's from the Numerical Discourses in the Book of Nines. It's number 5. And the Buddha talked about, well, it's in the Book of Nine, so there's going to be 9 of something in here. But actually, it's 4 powers and 5 fears. Totals up. But the 5 fears, I usually, when I talk about this sutta, I start there, because it's like, have you ever been afraid that you would lose your livelihood? Or get a bad reputation? Or did you ever have fear of speaking up in public? Or being in a, you know, some kind of assembly? Or fear of death? Or fear of what happens after death? And the Buddha said, if you develop these 4 powers, you never have to have those 5 fears again. You want to know what they are? So the first one that the Buddha talks about is the power of wisdom. And he defines it here. It's knowing what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. Basically knowing right from wrong. What are wholesome qualities? What are unwholesome qualities? And then the second power is the power of energy. Like the energy, the determination to develop the wholesome qualities and resist the unwholesome. And the third power he calls the power of blamelessness. So living your life in a way that, you know, everybody gets blamed at some point. People blamed the Buddha, you know, but just because people blame you, it doesn't mean that you're at fault. So if you develop a moral virtue and you really live according to that, then whatever anyone says, it doesn't go anywhere because it's not true. It's living blamelessly. And the fourth one, I found really surprising when I first read this sutta, because I hadn't seen it anywhere else before. And it was the power to sustain favorable relationships. And the Buddha said that there are four ways that you sustain favorable relationships. If someone can benefit from your giving them a gift, you give them a gift. If they could benefit from encouraging words, you give them encouraging, kind words. If they could benefit from a favor that you could do for them, some generous conduct, and you do them a favor. If they could benefit from being treated impartially, you're impartial. So I really reflected on these things. You know, it's like, how do these four things eliminate those five fears? How do you, well, the blamelessness, the knowing the wisdom of knowing what's wholesome and unwholesome and the energy to apply it, and then, you know, being blamed, that all kind of follows, right? And you can see why you wouldn't have to worry about dying. You wouldn't have to worry about what happens after death because it's going to be good. You know, I say that a lot to people when they talk about their dear mother who died or their son or child or whatever, and it's like, this person was a good person, they lived a good life, they're going to be okay. You know, it's just the way karma works. I mean, I never would say they're never going to have to fight in a battle if I knew they had the incredible kind of determination to not ever kill anything, then maybe I could, but that's pretty incredible. Anyway, and blamelessness, I mean, and not worrying about getting a bad reputation also makes sense if you're living such a upright, moral life. And the confidence that you develop, you know, to be able to be in any kind of group, in any kind of assembly, and hold your head up. You know, it's not a problem. Nothing to worry about. And then losing your livelihood, and then that's where I really started to think about this idea of favorable relationships. And I thought about my father. If you read that book, you'll find out a little bit about my father. he was always doing kind and generous things for people. And the farmers, you know, when you live around these same people for 50 years, and you help each other out, you know, and then you don't have to worry so much when something goes wrong because you've got this community around you. And I think that's a large part of the, you know, favorable relationships. And then the part about treating people impartially. I mean, you really think about how that feels, like if you're working on a team and the boss has a favorite person, or you get, you know, or being treated differently because of whatever characteristics we might have or something like that. But to treat people impartially, you know, what a beautiful thing that can be. It really creates trust and respect. And I remember there was this one lady in town that my mom said, yeah, I really like her. She's always the same. Another way of being impartial, you know, you just, yeah. So the Buddha gave us a lot of different, he gave a lot of different reflections on the way we can live our life and the results that can come from it. And he also very much talked about the importance of living our life in this good way as a way to develop meditation. You know, you really don't get very far if there's a lot of stuff that we're doing that isn't wholesome. And sometimes people want, they really want their meditation to go deeper, but we got to back up and look at how the precepts are going, you know. So those are some reflections for checking in on this whole idea of self. We train the mind. But it's not an identity to build. It's not a persona to build. It's a character to build. It's not something, it's not really about pride. It's more about confidence. You know, this doesn't give us a big head. It gives us humility and stability. And it's good to remember the good things that we've done. And I often talk about this thing that they do in Sri Lanka. I've been told a person will have a book where they write down all the good things they do, and the offerings they make and the kind things that they do for people. And then when the person's dying, a family member reads that out. Because you want to be thinking about that when you're dying and all the good things you've done. I feel like the Buddha's teachings take a lot of the questions about how should we live and what should we do with our time, and really gives us clarity. Questions? Adam?
This brought up a kind of a ethical conduct question that I often have for my own professional life. I'm a biologist, and sometimes it involves killing things. I try to avoid it as much as I can, but I don't know, it's just like something I've struggled with, like how to avoid things that we, in my case it's stream insects, we collect them to kind of monitor water quality. And it's been suggested to me to ask the other biologists to put them in the ethanol instead of me doing it. And that's maybe something, but it's...
Yeah.
I mean, I try to compensate it for it by being really meticulous about any killing outside of my work that I can.
Mm-hmm.
but it's hard to see a way out of it without leaving the job. So that's just, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, the first one's gonna sound a little flippant. Shave your head and become a monk. You've already thought about that, I think. Yeah. So the reality is that we do harm. Yeah, it's intentional killing that's the problem, of course. And I don't know if... Well, let's say... The Buddha was clear that the killing of a human being is the worst. Killing of large animals is worse than killing small animals, and killing insects is not as bad as killing people or large animals or animals, right? However, I can really appreciate wanting to not do it. Telling someone else to kill, at least if you look at the Vinaya, is the same offense. However, there are ways around these things that happen in monasteries, you know, because you can't always let the termites eat the huts. And I've learned a lot of ways of discouraging pests, if we feel like we can call them that, that don't involve killing, but often there comes a time when you have to make a decision to, you know, preserve something that's of value. And this is testing the water quality for the benefit of people.
And the insects.
Oh, so you're looking for, like, contamination. Is this the only way to do it?
It's a state program, and that's how the monitoring is done. You'd have to change state law to do it differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's. I think it's going to be a question only you can answer. There was a woman who came to Ajahn Gunha's monastery, and this was a few years ago when he was still answering lots of questions, and she asked about the ants in her house, and she just couldn't get rid of them. She tried all different things. And he kept saying that the most important thing is the purity of mind. And, you know, he wouldn't say, yeah, it's okay for you to kill the ants. And she's like, the way you're talking, then I should move. And he's like, yeah, you could move. I say, you could change your job. But that purity of mind, how do we create it? How do we cultivate it? And yeah, it's a dilemma. He'll often say, wisdom solves the problem.
Sometimes I get confused just reflecting on the difference between perception and mental formations. My understanding is mental formations are more the will and the... But how is it different? Like, where does thought belong? Which one of those is khandhas?
Yeah, I'm sorry, what was the last...
Which one of those khandhas?
Which one of those khandhas
does thought belong to? Perception
what?
Or...
Does which what
thought?
Belong? thought. Thought is usually the mental formations, like all the mental activity. And perception is a bit more primitive. That I know that this is a piece of paper. I know this is a bell. And it also is related to memory, which I wouldn't know that's a bell without some memory of being exposed to this kind of bell, right? And so, yeah, these khandhas, khandha is a word that means heap. Like the Buddha took these components that we think of as self and he put them in heaps to show us that it doesn't add up to a self. And the simile is like you take a chariot apart, so we use cars. You take a car apart and you lay all the pieces out. It's really not a car anymore. So the five khandhas taken together makes it all look very solid.
I work with that a lot. Yeah. It's not something we talk about very often explicitly in my community, but it really helps me. And I've read a lot, and different texts seem to sort of weave in different things there, so I wanted to know what the Buddha said. Thank you. I guess one other thing, when I return, I have the opportunity to be what we call a chief junior. So after a time, if I've been in my community for 15 years, and so I'll be kind of given the authority to sort of make sure things are getting done and helping people's practice, and it's a temporary position. And so as you were speaking today, I was thinking about, okay, well, how do I want to show up to this without creating a self around it,
Yeah.
And I think how my practice would lead me to think about that is, just watching for ego, watching for constructions about what that position means, and just really being in the moment of each interaction and doing what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, I like that. It's a position of service.
Yeah.
And seeing what's needed and doing it mindfully and kindly. And it can really be a beautiful way to meditate in action. Yeah, and you're wise, very wise, I think, to reflect on this ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And know that you don't want to become the, what is it called?
The Japanese word is shuso, but it means chief junior.
Chief junior. You don't want to become the, now I'm this. Yeah, so this is really good. This is good to reflect on. And that kind of little ego boost can come up in a flash. And then you catch it and you go, no. No. And the mind can change so fast. The Buddha said there isn't any simile you can give for how fast the mind can change.
I've learned to really just stay with it when things like that arise, though. Suppressing it or wishing it away doesn't help. I have that conditioning, and when I feel a little spike of something like that, I've been really well served to just really let it, just really notice it, and then really let it fade.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, the whatever arises in our emotional field, in our mind, we don't want to suppress it. Suppressing things causes them to come out in funny ways later. That doesn't work. And also indulging in it in a way, making more out of the story or whatever, that doesn't work either. And in my mind, I often have this vision of a ridge that you're walking that has a sharp down on each side, And this ridge you're walking is where you're aware and present with what this is, but you're not buying into it. You're not, you know, acting from that place. You're just aware. So it's exactly, I think, what you described. You're aware and present with this that has arisen in the mind, and then by being present with it, you can observe the changes and it fades. But you don't add anything to it and you don't try to suppress it. The two ways to fall off the path.
It's hard when something so explicitly un-Buddhist comes up. You know, I really had to work with that. It's like, how can a Buddhist be feeling, a Buddhist monk nonetheless, be feeling, you know, greed or ego or whatever it is, but it's there.
Oh, yeah.
And I just have to see it, and it does fade. So
yeah,
it's not me.
That's one of the selfing traps is, I should be further along than this. Or this is the way a Buddhist nun should act, or this is the way a minister should act, or this is the way whatever, you know. And yeah, we can't control what pops up in our mind. It's like tuning a radio when you used to like have a dial. We still got it on that truck, I think. But you know, it's like you get whatever you get gets pulled in on the signal, and whatever it's all past, it's all old. So when things come up, and you know, just remember this is old. This is from the past. I don't need to keep feeding this. And you just be with it, let it fade, let it die on its own. Anybody else? All good. It's probably a good time to most of you to meditate, and get our little, the last four of you, Adam, Carol, Sarah, and Debbie. And we'll meet in the classroom. And everybody else, please practice. And tonight we'll have our last session in the classroom with the PowerPoint presentation on the beautiful and the ugly, or not beautiful. Okay, yes, Molly.
I'm going to be reading with Suzanne. Is there a place where we
could
do that and say?
Oh, you're going to be reading.
I'm going to be reading to her.
Oh, yeah.
Where could we do that?
How about the dining room? That be okay?
Carol, where did you do it?
We did it in the dining room.
Oh, you did, okay.
Yeah, okay, great. Enjoy that.
Thank you.
You're gonna get a good dramatic reading, I can tell. That's pretty special.
A lot of not self.
Go with the not self, that's good. Yes, Debbie.
Yeah, I was going to mention, I don't know how you might be able to make that work, but Sutta Central has a section where you can listen to the suttas being read in English and in Pali. So you could, you know, if you don't have a reader readily available, and you say you can't read, but could you work the computer or get somebody to work the computer for you?
Possibly.
You know, because all of the suttas are there, my God, you know, look what you get to choose from.
Do they just have the part where they read a line is of Pali and then English, or do they also just have only English?
I think they do do both. The page you see may have both, but I think it's read in English separately from the Pali.
There's an option to choose.
Yes.
Oh, that's good. I just looked at it for the first time the other day, I didn't have the time to investigate much, so that's great. If you can just listen to the English.
It's a recent innovation on the site, I think. So So if somebody could set that up for you, you know, that would be fabulous.
What's the site?
Sutta Central, Ajahn Sujato's site for all of the suttas for the Tipitaka.
I think up at the top on the menu at the top, there's audio or audible or something like that.
There's a little picture icon of a speaker.
Yeah.
Right. That's right.
And then you can play the game. You can do a Turing test and tell if you're being read to by a human or the AI. Because they do have AI.
I'm glad to see AI as being useful. Okay. Thank you all.